Temporary it was. The flower white, that is. By the time I woke Thursday morning, I could see the miracle drug leaving my skin, emptying itself into my piss jar. I carried the chamber pot down the ladder and tossed the blue urine outside. Doc came by shortly after Pa got home. My skin had nearly returned to blue. Still, I had the whiteness, and Pa could see for himself the medicine worked. Elijah, Doc coaxed, at least have a tablet if you won't take the injection. I brought enough for both of you to take for a week, and I'll bring more. Just one day'll do it. He set the pill bottle on the table. Take it, I begged. It'll make things better. Try one, Elijah, Doc urged. Pa said, look at me, man. He held out his coal-stained hands, pointed to his dust-blackened face, then thumped his chest, smacking out a flurry of coal dust. Again, Pa hit his chest and coughed. The only thing that I'm needing fixed is this black sickness inside of me. Have you any tonic to cure that, doctor? Doc grimaced and squeezed Pa's shoulder. Most of his patients suffered from the lung disease. Dismayed at Pa's refusal, I scooped a dipper into a bucket of water, took a big gulp and swallowed a tablet, hoping he'd change his mind. Pa, please, just one. One! Pa waved a hand, dismissing the offer. Doc asked Pa questions, the names of our relatives. Absently, Pa told him. The doctor took out a pad and wrote them down, then pried some more, needling him for information on our kin. Shortly, my heart banged and seized hold of my head, all of it churning, turning my belly. I lifted my hands to see that I'd turned back to white. Baffled, Pa coughed violently. What is a lily? Lily, he barked out. For a moment, I felt like his perfect little girl. I smiled and fetched him some water. A white daughter. Pa hushed the words and took a sip. Shocked, he sank down in the chair and studied me. Doc talked to him more about the tests and the medical journal piece he planned to write. Pa, you can go to the mine as a white man. Take one. But Pa weren't listening to me or the doc, and a few minutes later, I flew out the door to relieve my stomach, same as last night. Finished, I crept back inside. Pa gawked at me, alarmed. Daughter, are you hurt? Doc shook his head. No, it's temporary, Elijah, like the drug. Temporary? Then it's a vanity, not a cure, Pa snapped. I winced. She should feel better directly. It's just a little discomfort that'll right itself, Blewett, the doc said with sympathy in his voice. Prideful, Pa grumbled. Dangerous. It's a safe cure, Doc insisted, and Blewett's strong. Pa scowled. Belladonna cures ails too, and it'll turn mean and slay the strongest. You can quit the medicine any time, dear, if the reaction is too much, Doc said to me. I could only murmur, yes, sir, but the thought of giving up my new color and going back to my ugly one sickened me more. Again, I urged Pa to take one too, but he just gave me a stony stare. Excited, Doc told Pa everything he discovered about the blues, our ancestors, the rare gene, and our missing oxygen, while Pa kept a sharp eye glued to me the whole time, watching me, watching my skin. But I barely noticed him. My eyes kept going to my hands and bare white skin, and I couldn't stop touching myself to see if the new flesh felt any different. I peeked into the looking glass and saw Pa's reflection. He cut a disapproving look, and I stepped back. But in a minute, I returned to the mirror to stare at myself, delighted, spellbound by my normal, pretty white skin. Soon I was practicing smiles and whispering at my reflection in my very best radio newscaster voice. Chapter 29. After Doc left, Junia's long, quavering bray sounded, and I peeked out the window, surprised to see Queenie. She nudged her mount closer to the porch. I'm going to pick up my last pay, she said, and slipped down off her horse, then stopped, pressed a hand to her chest. Lord love Betsy, what has happened to you, honey? You lost your color. Plum lost your blueberry now. It was said without meanness, but her words still made me flush. I rolled up my sleeves. The late June weather was sticky and hot. She glanced at my arms. Doc gave me some pills to try. Reckon they's working. Well, they sure enough work. Lord. She grabbed my hand and inspected. As if you wasn't pretty enough before, you're a mite prettier now. All of you. I blushed even harder at her compliment. Come on, you must come to town with me and show those bossy ladies your pretty self. They'll have themselves a passel of kittens and scratch each other up just as sharp when they get a look-see. Especially that old stinky polecat pussy, Miss Harriet. She tugged at my hand, laughing. Come on, it's Thursday, and you only have to go to your outpost today. I was going to pick up my pay later, but I reckon going early won't harm none. Let me get your dictionary. She held up her palm. You keep it, honey. 'Cause where I'm going, they'll have rooms full. But it was your pa's. My dear papa would be mighty pleased if you were the keeper of the words. I would too. And besides, you'll keep giving me your words. Only difference is you'll be posting them in letters. Letters. Liaison, litany, lithe, luminary, luxuriant. I said my latest new words, smiling as they flew musically out into the air. Don't you have yourself one fine, fine lexicon? Queenie said just as proud. You've made it up to your L's and so quick. Keep it, honey. We can't have you stuck in the L's like that. Much obliged. I'll take good care of it and write you. Maybe you can visit me one day. Be real nice to see the city together. Sure would be something, though I'd never have the money for such an extravagance. You try and come visit, honey. She patted my arm. It'd be real good to see different folk other than hill folk. We rode to town. When the nausea returned, I had to stop once and dismount to empty my stomach by the path, heaving, my breaths coming hard. Lord, Queenie called out and rushed up behind me. You okay, honey? Here, let me get you something for your sour belly. Did you have yourself a proper morning meal? She fussed over me, swept the hair back from my face. It'll pass once the medicine takes good root. I'm fine, I said between shallow breaths. In a minute, she pressed a jam-packed biscuit into my hand and ordered me to eat. I pushed it away. I'll not take your food. I wouldn't dare. It would be thieving, and all because of my vanity. The thought knotted my belly, and I pressed a fist into it. Queenie laid a soft hand on my shoulder. You will because I know plenty. Knowed you'd give me yours. Eat, honey. I sat on the ground and ate while she made sure I gobbled every bite. When I wiped away the last crumb, I felt stronger and was ready to journey on. Queenie ordered me to rest a few more minutes, and by the time we mounted, a half hour had passed, and I felt pert, excited, and scared about how folks would look at me, what they'd say. Queenie chatted about her new job. To think I'll be there in time to celebrate Independence Day. My independence, she smiled. I reckon that city'll have itself a grand parade. She shot me a look. You should go to Troublesome's this year. I've never been but once. I ticked off the 11 days until the 4th. I reckon they couldn't stop you now that you lost the color. I chewed on the notion. Queenie pulled back to her job. I aim to get myself a librarian degree. A degree? I said in awe. I've dreamed of opportunity forever, she said, to think how important it is for one to have chances over everything. They give the body life. I plucked up her words and turned them over in my mind. She went on. My sons and their sons will have it, and they won't be tethered to their color. Choked by the leashes of those who would cinch the tightest with the longest of ropes. Before today, I couldn't imagine there would be such opportunities in my blue world. Now my mind slipped over her bubbly talk, and it stole away to new thoughts of what might be, what I might become, dipped into fanciful worlds away from here. Safe in my mind, I had enough courage to take those opportunities I got from books and magpie them away as my own. We arrived in town, tied our mounts in the back of the post office, and walked into the library center together. Queenie chattered cheerfully and made me excited for her, for the both of us. As I stepped inside, I smoothed my skirts and began to roll down my sleeves when Harriet spotted my face and arms. She let out a gasp, then jumped up and screamed. "Out, out, out!" Harriet stabbed a finger to the door. "I knew you had the disease in you. You was just waiting to pass it to us godly folks. Both of you, out! Eula, Eula, make them leave!" Postmaster Bill poked his head around the post office's doorway and said, "Widow Fraser? Widow Fraser's sick." He crooked his head back and told someone in the post office, "Sir, you may want to see her." At that, Doc came up behind the postmaster, holding his mail. He pushed Bill aside. "What is it, Bill?" Postmaster Bill pointed to me. "What in tarnation? What's going on?" Doc demanded, confused. "Oh, Doc, it's one of the coloreds, the blue one," Harriet screeched. "Look, she's turned white from her disease and is going to infect us all." Eula, taking big gulps behind a hanky pressed over her nose, had rushed to Harriet's side. I wanted to turn and run for home, but Queenie latched tight onto my arm. "I said get out," Harriet ordered. "Get your filthy sickness away from us. You're fired. Eula, dismiss her." I felt the air leave me. Queenie patted my shoulder, whispered something soft into my ear. Doc stepped forward. "She is not sick. Mrs. Fraser is my patient, in my care, and I have declared her fit and of sound mind as any two strong men in this land." "But she's white. White," Harriet said. "And a fine, pretty white if I've ever seen one. And I've seen myself many, Miss Harden," Doc snapped, glaring at her over his spectacles. Harriet's eyes filled with rage. She raked them over the length of me. Then her chin lifted, and I glimpsed the tilt was unspoken jealousy. "But look at her, all of her," Harriet pointed to my face, neck, body. "Her whole figure, her—"
"Silence, madam,"
Doc barked and nailed his finger to Harriet's face, then slowly lowered it to her belly, poking.
"You, my dear, would do well health-wise to attend to your own figure. And if you cannot watch that," he jabbed his finger again, "be forewarned, nor will any man."
The old doc had a fury and might I'd never seen, a glint in his old eyes that rent a youthful, strong spirit. Queenie tightened a giggle, tapped a finger to her lips. Harriet bared her teeth and hissed. I realized I was holding my breath and slowly released it before I fainted, or worse. Doc thrust a hard jaw toward the assistant supervisor. Clutching her chest, Harriet opened, then snapped her mouth shut. Her lips quivered, and a harder anger spiked in her eyes, spilling hot tears. Again, she worked her mouth, clenched a fist. Afraid, I cast my eyes downward, stepped back. She picked up her skirts and ran into the ladies' room, slammed the door, rattling wood and windows. Eula plopped into the nearest chair, eyes downcast, wringing her handkerchief.
"Blew it," the doc boomed, and loud enough that I knowed Harriet heard, all of troublesome even. "May I say you're looking quite lovely today?"
Queenie murmured in agreement, and my face burned with pride and embarrassment. Never in my life had folks talked about me being pretty. My tongue tried to scrape off a proper thank you, but the word stayed locked, bubbling inside like a drowning frog.
"Yes," Doc said. "I'd wager the fairest lady in all Kentucky. Mrs. Johnson? Miss Foster?" He tipped his head to us. "Good day, ladies."
Doc slipped out the door. I let out a ragged breath. Eula still had her hands in her lap, folding and unfolding the hanky, as if waiting for someone to tell her what she should do next, or maybe even do it for her. Gracious, Queenie did just that, stepped over to her and said, "Miss Foster, I'm here for my final pay, ma'am."
"Yes, yes, of course," Eula managed hoarsely, dabbing her mouth with the handkerchief. She stood,
picked up an envelope off her desk and set it on the edge. Queenie took it. Eula swallowed twice and said,
"The..."
She sniffed and took a small breath. "The Pack Horse Librarians thank you for your service. Godspeed, Widow Johnson." Queenie gave her a tight smile, then reached over and touched my arm. "I'll write to you, honey, as soon as I'm settled. You write me back?" "Sure will," I promised, and Queenie was out the door. The screen clacked twice, cheering her on. I stared after her, thinking of the places she'd see, the people she'd meet, the opportunities she'd have. Finally, she'd be living the book she'd read about. Eula called my name.
"Widow Fraser?"
"Ma'am." She slid my pay envelope over to the edge.
"Your pay."
"Thank you, ma'am." I slipped it into my pocket and headed toward the door. Birdie strolled in with her baby hitched on a hip and stopped and turned to me, her young eyes dulled from restless nights.
"Blewett, you're..."
"White," I said happily.
"White? Oh, you're white."
I nodded. Doc gave me a cure.
"Oh my," she said. "So pretty, and the prettiest little daisy I've ever seen. Isn't that right, Samuel?"
She jiggled him up and down on her hip. The baby squealed with delight, poked a finger into his drooling mouth, and grinned at me.
"Yes, sir, our Blewett's a looker, and one of the boys are gonna want a hook," she told him teasingly. "And look at you, Samuel, already a-flirtin'."
Harriet walked out of the ladies' room.
"Uh-huh, one pretty lady," Birdie said.
Harriet's heel landed beside me. She leaned her head dangerously close to mine. "A pig in lipstick is still a stinking pig," she spat, her wet hiss spinning in the air as she swept past to her desk. I turned. Her red eyes bored into mine, and I held them, locked, and lifted my chin 2-man tall, snatching back some of the humankind that had been stolen. Chapter 30. It had been a perfect June morning, and I rode away from town pleased I had money to give Pa, pleased with my new color. I found a spot along the creek to let Junior drink from and dallied a little longer, thinking a clever talk I could have with Mr. Lovett next Monday, eager to show him my new color. I mounted and headed to my outpost, anxious to see what the courier had dropped off. Soon, the hardness of my morning spent at the center, Queenie's leaving, Harriet and Eula's fussing, caught up with me, and in a few moments a headache reached my temples and tightened a band around my head. I pressed a hanky to my forehead, fanned my neck. On Knob Trail, I passed a few folks headed into town, a man with a cart full of wares and a woman and small child carrying baskets. A few minutes later, I heard the high whinny of someone else's mount. I pulled Junior's reins to the right, stepping slightly off the path to let the rider pass. The mule stopped and pricked her ears when she saw him. Jackson Lovett rode toward us on a strong chestnut horse. Junior blew twice to let them know to step aside. He galloped onward, stopping beside us. "Cussie Mary, I'm taking my new horse into town to meet some men about timber. And here you are, and just in time to say hello." His smile disappeared. Leaning forward, his eyes fixed on me, brows knitted in concern, a worriment peeking in his eyes. Again, he searched my face. My skin grew hot and my mouth became dusty as I called out a greeting. Then everything blurred and I was fallen. 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 I came to on the ground. Jackson's head bent over mine, his hands cradling, rubbing mine. I'd fainted or died, maybe both, I couldn't be sure. But I felt a dreamy grin on my lips, a warmth in his touch of a kind I had never known. He squeezed my hand and called to me once, twice. "Cussie Mary?" He tapped lightly on my shoulder, rubbed my hand. I bolted upright, sat up and scanned my surroundings, sure I was dreaming it all. "Cussie, are you ill?" He gripped my arm and I blinked and pulled to his voice and saw his wide eyes darken. "Talk to me," Are you hurt?
I'm fine. It's only the medicine. I pressed my hands to my warm cheeks, shook away the grogginess.
Medicine?
I pulled myself to my knees and drew breaths. Jackson lifted me to my feet. Junia gave a weak bray, kept a big eye pinned to us.
Doc found a cure for my color.
I patted my hair and dusted my skirts, feeling horribly embarrassed.
And it makes you faint?
No, it upsets my belly and gives me fierce headaches. This is the first time I've had this type of spell. It usually rots itself as the day wears on and the medicine gets out of my body. I turned back to Blue. I shook my skirts again.
Turn back? It's temporary?
I hesitated, wanting it to be forever. For him to see me like this, always. Yes, I said, feeling a sadness rise as I searched his eyes for disappointment. It's temporary. Jackson shook his head.
You could have broke your neck just now.
He waited, thinking. Then,
lots of cures are worse than what they aim to cure. Are you stuck with it, or can you toss it?
I stammered. Doc said I could stop any time if I couldn't take the reactions. I felt a flush color in my ears and crawl over my face. It was vanity that made me use Doc's medicine and keep using it. And one of the deadly sins of the Lord Almighty. Now Jackson thought I was foolish and vain.
There's nothing wrong with your color, being you, he said firmly. Nothing wrong with what the good Lord gives us in his world, Cousin Mary.
He didn't know, couldn't know the load I'd carried as a Blue, the scorn and hatred and gruesome marriage. How dare Pa call me vain? And now Jackson? How dare he too?
Nothing wrong, Jackson repeated.
I stepped back and shot out a shaky hand. No, Jackson Lovett, you're wrong. There is nothing wrong with your color in your world. A world that wants only whiteness. He flinched, and his eyes filled with a mixture of hurt, sadness, maybe pity. I couldn't be sure, but I wouldn't wait to find out. I spun on my heels and grabbed Junior's straps. Hoisting myself up, I snapped the reins, and we broke into a fast run. Dear Lord, I said when we were far away, pressing my face, the shame, into Junior's fur. God, what has happened to me? Who have I become? And how small have I become? Mama would be so ashamed. And thinking about her, and the burdens my folks carried, and the grace they'd carried them with, made me feel smaller. Chapter 31. The second hot day of July wore on me, and I rested more times than I dared on my route up Hogtail Mountain, each time feeling sicker and weaker. It had been 9 days since I'd started taking Doc's medicine, and I still felt bad, still thirsted for water, especially in the mornings. It seemed like with each passing day, the medicine was making me feel worse. So much that I took to leaving all loans on the porches, avoiding my patrons. Today I tried to get food down, but it came right back up. Junia's big eyes worried over my shoulder, and she nuzzled my back the second time I emptied my aching belly onto the road. My skin felt feverish, and my throat was raw from retching. With a pounding head, I finally reached R.C.'s fire tower. R.C. poked his face over the rail, waved, then disappeared back inside. I tied Junia and looked up the steep staircase. Digging into the book satchel, I pulled out R.C.'s magazine and the 4th celebration flyer the company store left at the center to be passed out. I hoped R.C. didn't have himself a fire somewhere. Prayed I wouldn't have to climb to the top today, of all days. Still, I always wanted to please the patron and leave the loan where they wanted it. I waited a long time, but didn't hear his footfalls on the metal stairs or his voice calling down to me. I'd have to brave the climb. I cursed the Blue drug and then my vanity as I trudged up the steps to the first landing. Overhead, I heard R.C. open the door and clomp down the stairs. I blew a shaky breath, grabbed the railing, and waited. When R.C. came into view above me, I covered my mouth to silence a cry. But R.C. beat me to it. He ran toward me, leaving behind a girl who'd been trailing him.
Bookwoman! Miss Blewett, what happened?
He hollered, jumping the last three steps onto the landing beside me and dropping his old loan. The steel rattled, crawled up into my feet, and echoed into my aching head, leaving me to sway a little. He'd been in an accident, maybe worse. His face was bruised blue as the color that stained my chamber pot each morning since I'd been taking the methylene.
Here, have a seat, he pointed to a step. You're white as the fog up here after a heavy rain.
How many times had I envied those words, white as. How desperately I'd wanted those words for my own. A prideful thing. I could stop this madness now, toss the medicine, but I craved the color more. I am a little under the weather, R.C.
Over his shoulder, a girl stood behind him. She was reed thin with big doe brown eyes. There was a cut on her mouth, and one eye was swollen and bruised purple.
The boy looked worse. His nose sat crooked, and an arm hung limp and twisted to the side. A front tooth was missing, and good part of his left ear had been clipped.
R.C., what happened? Does it hurt? I asked.
You must be in a lot of pain.
Here, you sit.
I scooted over. R.C. waved away my concerns.
Hold on, ma'am. Stay seated, and I'll get you something to help.
I'm fine. Please don't trouble yourself. I pleaded, worried he'd hurt himself more fussing after me. But he was off, racing up the steps, thundering his way back to the cabin. The young girl stared at me, rocking on the balls of her feet. She glanced up the stairs and said quietly, "My man's a good one. Smart. He's gonna learn me the books, too." Feeling ill, I could only bob my head. "My daddy said we could live with him, but that tin room up in the sky there," she raised her chin, "is bigger than Daddy's whole cabin," Ruth chattered on. "R.C. turned him down. Said he's looking to grow our babies up here, just like his folks done with him. He's gonna work himself up to forestry dispatcher and then get the schooling to be a forest ranger. Be the lawman of the whole forest. He's real smart like that," she said again, proud. "He is. I'm sure you'll be happy here." I wished it. "I sure is happy to be with my man. My brothers were real ornery, and my daddy and them whipped me a lot, but R.C. sweared he won't whoop on me." R.C. came tromping down the stairs. He handed me a mug of water and shoved a generous piece of yellow root into my hand. I murmured thanks in between tiny sips and gnawed on the root while R.C. and Ruth watched. In a minute, the herb eased my ails. Standing, I gave my thanks again, set the cup on the rail, and pocketed the yellow root. We swapped out his old newspaper loan for a fairly decent copy of an American Forest magazine and the flyer. "This just came in from Lexington," I said, pleased to give it to him.
"Oh, Miss Blewett, this magazine is surely a great one," R.C. exclaimed. "It's gonna be the best. Look, Ruth."
He handed her the advertisement for the fourth celebration. "Here's a celebration I told you about." R.C. showed her the flyer and pulled her up beside him.
"Shoot, ma'am. I plumb forgot my manners. This is Ruth. Ruth Cole, my bride. Ruth, this is Bookwoman, but you can call her Blewett, though she don't look much like a damselfly today," he grinned.
"Hello, Ruth," I mustered a smile. Ruth looked down at her bare feet. "We's met, R.C." She dropped into a half-curtsy for me. "Howdy again, ma'am." R.C. beamed.
"Do you think you can bring her some of them female magazines and scrapbooks, ma'am? I'm gonna learn her to read."
"I sure will."
"Ruth, you best go back up and watch the Osborne. Hot one coming up today. I'll see Bookwoman down."
She gave a shy wave and said, "Hope to see you at the Independence celebration tomorrow, ma'am. R.C. done told me all about it. And the forestry is giving my man 2 paid days off starting tomorrow."
R.C. led me down the steps. At the bottom, he said, "I never did thank you proper for bringing me the letter the last time, ma'am. Mr. Beck didn't want to let Ruth go, and he whipped her."
He tilted his head up to the sky, squinting. I had to fight him for her.
I'd heard some unfavored quarters did that.
Had to fight for a bride? A test to join another clan. I'm sorry, RC, I said, letting him talk it out. Him and his sons tore into me, busted me some. He wrinkled his broken nose and winced, then rubbed a shoulder. Didn't matter none when this was already busted. RC thumped his chest. I took their whippings, and they was mean ones all right, but I got my licks in, mind you, he added. After, they said I'd earned her, and we drank to it. His smile was childlike, but a manliness settled into his face after what he'd done. We had us a preacher over in Crooked Branch officiate it, and afterward her family put on a right good feast. Congratulations on your marriage. Be well, I dared to lightly touch his arm. He didn't pull away, just scratched his head and beamed. I'd take a dozen whoopings for that girl. I stared at him, awed by what lengths folks go to for love. Yes, sir, 2 dozen even, RC said proudly. I couldn't imagine finding any man that would take one for me. And for a moment, I tried. Feel better, ma'am. And you be sure and nibble on that root and get yourself well. You're mighty important to us and all. Can't have you sick or worse. Worse. The word slid over me, leaving its biting mark. That the drug could cause such fierce reactions made me suddenly wonder if it could get worse. Chapter 32. Heat trembled atop skinny pine forests and licked at mountain rock that rose above Troublesome. The hand on my pocket watch hadn't struck 8, and the July morning was already boiling, the blanket of air clammy, pleated with buzzes of excitement over the town and its tiny Independence Day celebration. I snapped the pear case shut, slipped the timepiece back into my skirts, and watched from atop Junia behind a thicket of brush and tall briar on a knoll as folk set up tables below, went about fancying the town for their big 2-day celebration. Several times I glanced at my pale hands, each time feeling relieved, my excitement growing as I dared to go down and join the white folk. Women carried cakes, pies, and tasty eats and arranged them on red checkered cloth tables. Menfolk sliced watermelon and made a dandy spread of deer sausage and other game they'd trapped for the festivities. Folks gathered at the company store to chatter. Families claimed patches of grass in shady spots and spread out quilts and baskets, groaning with prized recipes. I ran my hand down over my thick saddlebag. It held a scripture cake, one of the first recipes Mama taught me so I'd learn my Bible verses while baking. I had cut the cake with cinnamon, figs, and a dollop of expensive sorghum I'd saved up for, and had Pa tote home from the company store after Queenie had suggested I attend the celebration. Pa usually balked at spending money like that, frittering away hard work and pay, but he weakened when I told him it was Mama's recipe. I'd made a smaller cake for him, and he'd ate it heartily, grunting compliments in between mouthfuls. Surely it was good enough for today. Impatient, Junia nickered for us to go. I fought again to get my gumption up, wavered between turning for home or joining the townsfolk. I stared down at the crowd, lifted an arm, and admired my new color. I didn't have to watch this celebration from a window, and I took a deep breath and snapped the reins. Gee! The mule agreed and hurried down the slope. I led her over to the post office, dismounted, and watched the coming and going of happy folks, curious, wide-eyed children, men gussied up in their Sunday duds and smart hats, and women in new sewn dresses. Youngins played tag and kicked the can in the dusty street. A group of small girls held up new apple dollies their mamas had peeled and carved out from fat Granny Smith's, showing off the funny face whittled fruits. 3 boys sat on a stoop at the post office with a pile of forest sticks and made whimmy diddles, digging out notches on the wood toy with their pocket knives, carefully selecting more sturdy twigs to make the wooden spinners to top them. Gee-haw, one of them shouted, raised his new toy and furiously rubbed the notched whimmy diddle with a thick stick to make the top spin. A few folks had set up display tables to sell deerskins, coon caps, rabbit foot charms, and other pelts they'd fashioned from their hunts. Junia lifted her nose toward a large cast-iron pot hanging over a small fire. The aroma of turtle soup filled the air with garlic and onion and other spices. The company store had set up a stand under a banner, and red, white, and blue streamers with Old Glory were mounted beside it. A man in a yellow bow tie stood in front of the wooden booth, barking at passersby. "Get your tickets for a chance to win the celebration quilt from Troublesome's Finest Sewing Club. Tomorrow at dusk, one lucky winner takes home this year's quilt. Right here, step up and get your ticket," he barked. The booth was stocked with handheld flags, spangle sparkler lights, rockets and firecrackers, candy treats, and other notions they would give to the townsfolk. The 4th was the only time out of the year the company shut down the mine for a 2-day holiday and donated goods to Troublesome. Families would come down from their hollers, across creeks and out of coves to enjoy the free festivities, stuffing themselves and having an excited social with their neighbors. My folks had taken me once when I was little. We'd gone with Uncle Colton. A fight had broken out when a drunk put his hands on Colton's wife. Words and slurs had hit the blues like punches, and Pa had grabbed Uncle Colton, his wife, Mama, and me, and rushed us back to the holler. That was the last time I saw my uncle, the last Independence Day celebration we'd attended. "But I'm white now, and a respectable librarian," I told Pa last night when he insisted I stay home. "Daughter, no good will come of you going to mingle with them folks," he'd warned.
"I'm the same as them now, Pa. Look at me. Look at my color."
"I don't like it," he grumbled. "Those that can't see past a folk's skin color have a hard difference in them. There's a fire in that difference. And when they see you, they'll still see a blue. No city drug's gonna change small minds, what they think about peculiarity. For them like-minded folks, there is no redemption for our kind. Stay put where you belong, cussy."
Two youngins raced past me, brushing my skirts. I recognized one of them as Winnie's student. He stopped and turned back to me, waving a handful of sparklers.
"Buck woman, look a-here!"
The boy raised the fireworks higher.
"It's July 3rd, and these are for me. I'm 8 today, and Pa says all these fireworks are for my birthday. And we're gonna celebrate it Thursday and Friday."
He grinned and was off to catch up with his friend, not even noticing or caring about my color. Again, I checked my hands. The celebration crowd was growing larger, and laughter floated down the street. I tied Junia to her spot at the post office, straightened my skirts, and carried the pie toward one of the gathering tables the townsmen had built, suddenly aware that the excited folks weren't really paying attention to me at all, that Pa was wrong. I belonged, same as everyone else. With a lightness in my step, I found myself smiling. I spied Jackson ride in on his horse and watched him secure it next to the company store. Harriet, in a new flower blossom dress, rushed up to greet him, full of the once-a-year fever that came with the town's special day. She jabbered happily at him, trying to keep up with his long strides until Jackson said something to her, tipped his brim, and moved on to a small group of men. One of them, Mr. Dalton, Troublesome's banker, greeted him with a friendly slap on the back, and the other men shook his hand heartily. He didn't see me when I bustled past toward the sewing circle. Likely he wouldn't want to, neither, after the fuss I'd made on the trail. It was just as well. He was a patron, and only that. I'd been foolish to think our friendship meant more, or could ever be. I approached the table with 7 women around it. Constance Poole and her sewing bee chattered gaily over the folds of fabric, putting the finishing touches on the celebration quilt. From a few feet back, I admired their workmanship, studied the red, white, and blue blocked star design, and listened to their excited talk. I reached up and touched my collar, then inspected my capped sleeves, my own needlework. I'd searched through magazine advertisements for dresses and hairstyles, then through our trunks and found some old lace and a few seed pearls of Mama's and sewed them around the neck and onto the sleeves of my old soft brown dress to make it more fashionable and less drab. For the past week, I'd practiced rag curling my hair into soft, wavy curls. This morning, I awoke hours before dawn and carefully worked damp ringlets around the strips of fabric. When my hair dried, I pulled it all back loosely with Doc's new white ribbons. I could see Constance Poole and the others sharing amusing stories as their busy fingers lit across the quilt, expertly stitching and knotting. One lady urged Constance to go over and say hello to someone. "Exchange a proper festive greeting," she poked. "Sure would be a fine one to court." The others chimed in, agreeing, whispering, and then I heard his name. Constance glanced over her shoulder right at Jackson. Her cheeks rosied as the girls' voices chorused into giggles and gossip about Troublesome's latest eligible man. Their lively talk covered a few other men, tales of courtship, but twice I caught Constance sneaking glimpses back at Jackson. I could tell she was sweet on him. They would make a handsome couple, her with the lovely ivory face and him with the strong, handsome one. They could be one of the dashing couples I'd seen in the magazines. A Cinderella and the Prince. My old color crept into mind, doubt pricked, and I looked away, feeling dimmed by her beauty, knowing my new looks were just temporary, that I could turn back into a pumpkin just as quick. Checking my hands, I was relieved to see they didn't betray my jealousy. A group of youngins chased each other past the table, their screams jarring my thoughts. Clutching the cake, I smoothed down my skirts with my free hand and patted my ruffled collar, anxious fingers traveling upward, worrying my new hairdo. The cake suddenly felt heavy in my other hand, the heat just as heavy and pressing. A dull headache throbbed at the base of my head, crawled up behind the ears, and I blinked and slightly rolled my shoulders to dismiss it. Silently, I counted the steps that would take me safely back to Junia, each number niggling, telling me to turn back to her now. The table of ladies exploded with laughter at something that I didn't hear. I searched their pink faces, glanced at my arms. I'm white. White. I pounded the declaration into my brain, chasing off misgivings. Taking a breath, then another, I stepped up to Constance. "Miss Poole, ladies, happy fourth." I held out the cake and shot them my best smile. Ma'am, I made a scripture cake and thought the sewing ladies might enjoy a slice. It was my mama's favorite, an old family recipe passed down from her grandma. Constance's eyes bugged, and a gasping hush locked the other women's wagging tongues. "Why, Widow Fraser, you've turned white. Are you unwell?" She snatched a hanky from the folds of her skirts, patted a shiny forehead and pinched mouth. The other women scooted together, clattering their chairs against each other's legs, their six faces pinned to mine and snaking over the length of me. "Fine, ma'am." I added an extra dollop of long sweetening to the recipe. I thrust the cake out, tried to give it to her, but she flinched, fell back against her chair. I wanted to stop by and see if I could join you, maybe lend a hand on the quilt. I've got a tight running stitch, and my mama always said it's one of the best she'd seen, and I slipped a finger under my dampening collar, tugged lightly, and searched their faces. And then, because it might be friendlier, safer, I added, "Sure don't remember a fourth as hot as this one." Uneasy silence batted around the group, shivering the hot, steamy air. Nearby, a firecracker went off, making us all jump and leaving the ladies bleeding nervously. Constance balled her hand over a working patch on the quilt. "I've got a decent chain stitch, too, and my blind stitch is..." I hesitated, desperation sneaking into my wavering voice. The woman looked to her companions, a silent question passing over each one, a fretful answer in their narrow eyes. I darted a shy smile around the group, hoping. Constance cleared her throat. "Widow Fraser, we have 7 in our sewing bee, and we'd like to keep it at a comfortable 7. She turned her head back to the women's approving glances, tossed a grim, satisfied smile to her group, picked up a needle, and dipped in and out of the quilt, picking up speed. A heavy moment passed. Hard, whispery voices buzzed before the ladies lifted their prattle back to sewing and the affairs of the celebration, dismissing me.
Have you ever a heathen making a Bible cake?
One spat out low.
Disgraceful spectacle.
An older woman hissed while her seatmate snuck a pitying glance my way. A younger girl with dimples and cold blue eyes looked at me like I had the nuisance of a small bother. Another shot a look of triumph, and still another's eyes burned with anger.
Disgraceful spectacle. Heathen.
I tucked my head. The hurtled words battered me like stones. The air felt like I was wearing it and had caught fire, trapping me. Another firecracker went off and broke my prison, sending me scurrying back to Junia with the cake clasped in my hands. I chanced to peek back to the table of tittering ladies, then pinched my wrist and watched the white skin pucker and sink back into the flesh, into my shame and sadness. Again, I pinched harder, dug in, the punishment not near enough for my grave transgression. I'd been foolish, reached the worst. The drug had not redeemed me. I didn't belong at this bright, happy gathering with these lively folks and bubbly chatter. I belonged in darker places where darker thoughts kept me put, where sunlight, a cheerful voice, or a warm touch never reached me. Weren't no pill ever going to change that. I threw the cake into a bush and mounted Junia, glancing once more at the crowd. Across the street, Jackson talked to a group of smiling men and women. He lifted his head my way, raised a hand, and called out, "Cussie Mary." I couldn't bear for him to see my disgrace, see me for who I really was, who I'd become in their eyes. Gee, I kneed the mule hard, and she raced off toward our dead, dark holler. Chapter 33. Even though the packhorse librarians had 2 days off for the 4th, I left the celebration and rode to my outpost to be alone, stopping twice to empty my belly, the medicine and nerves wearing me. Determined, I climbed back into the saddle and continued on. While I was there, I'd pick up the courier's new parcels for my Friday route. I couldn't let down the small community that would be waiting for the new loans tomorrow, and I needed to be in the chapel with my dark thoughts. Soon those hard feelings dissolved, and my belly righted as I delved into the reading materials and escaped to my books. On Friday, it took all day to reach my patron through the Darkly Passes. Toting my heaviest book bags, weighing close to 50 pounds, wore on Junia. The mule plowed heavily along rugged passes thick with vines, branches, and briars, crossed trickling creek waters, and twisted around thickets of scrub pine and beyond until we came to a pinhole passage that kept us from going any farther. The skies opened, and down came steady rain, pushing up scents of new earth and aging rot. I didn't mind. It helped numb my thoughts of the sewing bee, of Jackson Lovett, what had been said and what was best left unsaid, and now what would never come to be. I lifted my face and let the rain wash it, pelt at me. I could see the patron ahead. Weather never stopped him, and despite feeling poorly, I wiped my face and waved. Soft light he was, and just as welcoming, bathed in his own sunny color. 40-year-old Orrin Taft stood grinning in tattered wet clothes, a bright green cap atop his long brown hair, as he waited beside the small headstones rising from the weeds. I returned his smile, feeling the warmth of it on this cloudless day. Not far from the tiny graveyard stood his grandparents' abandoned home, propped on leaning sticks, the gray walls sunken, the rotted weatherboards gaping, weakened from years of rains and damp woods, and the patching of thickening wisteria under a roof buckling to rainy skies. Wild roses climbed up crumbling chimney rock, creeping over a pile of broken stone, their soft pink blooms tangled with the wild purple wisteria, lifting a slight fragrance into the rain, rising up on the dismal day.
"Good afternoon, book lady. I didn't much expect you today, it being the 4th. Thought I would chance it, and I'm mighty glad I did," he said cheerfully, standing guard over two toe sacks. "Afternoon, Mr. Taft. Happy 4th, sir.
The mule stretched out her neck and blew at him. Mr. Taft stepped out of Junia's path over to his grandparents' home, wisely distancing himself from her temper until I tethered her. I tied Junia to a tree next to a broken gravestone and unloaded the books onto a board under a thick arch made from grapevine Mr. Taft had woven into a cover for the books. Mr. Taft's tiny community of 11 families lived over the mountain from where we were standing in a place called Tobacco Top. An impossible pass for even the smallest of beasts. They were holler dwellers, the poorest, and what most mountain folk looked down on. Without fail, every Friday, he'd meet me at his old family homestead after hiking the 8 miles to get the reading, drop off his loans, and tote his new ones back to the isolated families waiting. Mr. Taft snuck glances at my face, puzzled by my new color. "Are you well today?" he called as he walked toward me. "I hope they ain't working you too hard." I stacked the reading materials neatly under the arch. "Fit, sir, just spent from the rains." I pulled my floppy hat down over my white forehead, let the rain trickle off the wide brim and onto my shoes. The drug still made me sick every time. And at least once a day, Pa needled me to stop taking the tablets and threatened to throw them out. Mr. Taft pulled out a small cloth bag. "This'll cure any ails. My woman said to give you these and to thank you for the books." I opened the bulging bag and the scent of strong onion tickled my nose. Inside were fat ramps. "There's a note she tucked in for you," he said. I pulled out the paper and held it under my brim of my hat and out of the rain. "It's mighty good and some of the finest biscuits in these parts," Mr. Taft assured. "It sure looks it." It was a recipe for ramp biscuits with hog jowl. "You just crisp up that jowl, then put 'em and these ramps into your dough." He patted his slim belly. "Better than my granny's. Pa'll love it, and folks will surely use this fine recipe. Much obliged to your missus. Thank you both." I handed him back the bag, reluctant to take the ramps, and especially after I'd thrown away the cake at the celebration when so many hungered. He shook his head. "Oh no, ma'am. My woman will skin my hide if I don't give them all to you." It would fatten a lot of meager meals. Meals I feared I'd be taking from others. Meals I didn't deserve. I glanced at his rail-thin arms, busted shoes. Mr. Taft pushed. "Real good in the eggs, and if you get yourself a fat turkey, well, my woman stuffs it full with them." Again, he rubbed his belly. "Good eats." "She must be a fine cook." "Yes, ma'am. Ain't none better in these mountains. Best biscuits I've ever had on this good earth." He beamed. "Thank you, Mr. Taft. It's a fine gift. I should get your loans into my satchel and your new ones into your bags before it kicks up a real storm." We finished our exchange, and again Mr. Taft thanked me mightily while tying up his bags. I mounted Junia and watched him while he secured his books. Like me, he'd never missed a day. Nary a one, in sleet, snow, or rain. He was a big extension of my borrowing branch, a librarian in his own right. So much so that I called out to him, "Mr. Taft?" "Ma'am?" "There's a new posting down at the center for a pack horse librarian. And I thought of you, sir." I stopped, worried I'd gone too far, been too bold for this humble man. Would he see it as charity? Scold me? I glanced again at his shoes, the leathers popped full of holes and peeling away, then back at him, hoping I hadn't offended him. Just when I was about to work up an apology, he raised a brow. "Librarian?" His face opened up with pleasure and surprise. The job was still posted. It had been hard to find someone to take on Queenie's route. But if anyone could, it would be him. "Yes, sir, we have us a few men in service now, and you'd make a fine one. The pay's decent." "Pay?" His eyes widened. "Been a long time since I've seen that." The supervisors would hire him, if for nothing else than to have a man around to preen in front of, help with the crates and bulky packages, the heavier jobs. I looked over at his family's old home. With some patching, it would make a good outpost for the carrier to drop off the loans for him. "At the center?" he said. "Yes, sir. You can pick up an application at the post office, too." "Thank you kindly, book lady,"
It'd be an honor and a good fortune for me and mine. God bless you. He hoisted his book bags higher on his back. A librarian? Ain't that something now? Won't my woman be surprised? He shook his head, still trying to grasp the notion. Then, where's my manners? I hope you get to feeling pert soon, ma'am. I miss seeing my Bonnie Picasso. He grinned. I stared at him blankly, and he added, Picasso's painting of the pretty blue lady, the woman with a helmet of hair that I'd seen in one of the magazines you brought us. You remind me of her. You're a fine color. My woman always said God save that best color for his home. He pointed a finger up to a patch of blue sky parting the gray clouds. Guess he must have had himself a little left over. Astonished, I could feel my face warm. No one, not a soul, ever said my old color was fine. The best. Then he was off. The mule kept her eyes on the man till she was sure his distance was safe. Time to go, old girl. I watched him a moment and then flapped my legs against Junior's side. Mr. Taft hauled the books onto his back like the storybook Santa Claus, whistling into the rainy air, then meandered down the path and disappeared into the foggy, needle-eyed opening at the end. Chapter 34. The weekend found me fainting again as I stepped off the bottom rung of the loft ladder and spilled into Pa's arms. When I came to, Pa scolded my vanity and my new color and damned our blue affliction. Damn it, cussy, he gripped my shoulders. You'll not have the pills and your route, too. It's prideful, dangerous, and I forbid it. I escaped his hold and crumpled to the floor. Pa knelt down beside me, his bones stiff, creaky, and took me into his arms and cradled me, rocking. My daughter, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry for giving you this damn curse. Dear God, how I wish I hadn't. Dear God, forgive me. A tear sprung from his eyes, splashed onto my arm. Frightened for us, ashamed of my foolish airs, unable to witness the hurt, his sadness, I could only press my face into his chest and sob. It was the last morning I took the methylene blue. The last time I missed what I could never have and what was so foolish to miss. My pride, the hardships I placed on Pa and me, came at a bigger cost than I could bear. I couldn't lose any more, and I wouldn't lose my route. The pills had already worn down my spirits, whittled my nerves. I had to get my books to folks. To hell with the color of my skin. Jackson's words back on the path held a hard truth, too. There had been Orrin Taft's words yesterday, and the more I thought about his Picasso blue lady, her fine color, the best color, the more I reckoned God wanted me to have it. If it was good enough for him and the famous artist, it had to be good enough for me. Blue had to be enough for me, I vowed. The next morning I looked into the mirror, a little afraid. The white had quickly faded, and the blue rose on my flesh, deepening, bruising, as I narrowed my eyes and whispered to my reflection, this must be enough. I am enough. Pa slipped up behind me, silently placed his gnarled blue hands on my shoulders and squeezed lightly. Doc didn't seem to mind. That's fine, my dear. We wouldn't want to add more discomfort to your burdens. And I caught that by burdens he meant my lot in life, my color. Should you change your mind, Blewett, call on me and I'll get you more, Doc had reminded when he dropped off a small basket of bread and fruits. He'd been busy minding his own, writing for the medical journals, drafting new letters, he'd said, before doing a quick check of Pa's lungs and heart, and mine too. But his visits became short, and far and few between, until we rarely saw him at all, and then only in passing when he'd wave and give a cheery greeting. Late afternoon, I rode into the empty schoolyard. A hot breeze teased the long July day as I plucked lightly at my damp collar and fluffed my sticky skirts. The goat and chickens ignored Junior's worn call. New diddles poked their feathered heads up from the bottom of the coop, curious of our arrival. A hen flew down from her perch, protective of the baby chicks.
The school was unusually quiet for a Monday, and I thought they might be having a test. Mountain schools didn't have much of a schedule, keeping more or less to nature's calendar. Fewer school days in the harsh winter meant more and longer when it turned mild. On the hottest days, the students would take their lessons outside under a shade tree. Winnie appeared in the doorway holding her loans. I nudged Junia over to her. The second I slipped off the mule, she rooted herself, refusing to let me tether her. Gee. I pulled on her reins once and then again. She wouldn't budge. I dropped the lead, knowing Junia wasn't going anywhere, and I didn't have to win every argument. Cussie Mary, Winnie said, stepping down off the wooden stairs into the dirt yard. The children will be sorry they missed you again. Sorry, ma'am. Last week when I was ill, I'd snuck in and left the loans on the stoop, not wanting them to see my new color or the illness caused by it. You've discharged them early? We exchanged books. The school's closed for the day. The superintendent came by for his annual meeting and to look over the children's studies. I suppose it was about time since he's missed the last 2 years. Together we tucked the old loans inside my saddlebags. Yes, ma'am, I said, and mounted. The superintendent said the WPA is building a new stone school. A stone school? I said, astonished. It was something Winnie had dreamed of. Everybody had. I won't see it. Winnie fidgeted with her apron and patted the tight knot of hair on the back of her head. Albert sent word to the superintendent for me. He says I am to join him in Detroit. He'll pick me up at the train depot on August 8th. He'll be happy to see you, ma'am. Will a new teacher be sent? I asked, sorry she would go. It may be a while. I wish I could delay my move till we can find a teacher. I asked, but... Winnie looked down at her hands, rubbed reddened fingertips over her short nails. Well, he's anxious for my arrival. I'm sorry you can't stay. Me too, but you know how that is. It could be 6 months to a year before they find my replacement. Winnie had taught the longest of any before her, for nearly 3 years. It was impossible to get a teacher into these hills, and for chicken scratch at that. Most weren't cut out for it, and they'd pack their bags mid-year. I'd like to wait around just a little longer, she sighed, but the superintendent said he wouldn't give me permission to stay unless my husband granted it. It must be hard on Winnie to leave her students. Still, there was nothing she could do without her husband's consent. Winnie wiped her brow, patted her flushed neck. Cussie Mary, I need a favor. Happy to oblige. Some kind soul had been dropping off a few food sacks, but they only stretched so far and... She rubbed watery eyes. Well, it's Henry.